I'm talking to Tony Doonan.
Yeah.
And Tony, tell me, you're now living in Lisnaskey, is that right?
Yes.
But where did you grow up?
In Kinnaly, Swanland Bar. I am on the border. I was born in Kinnaly, which is the northern side of the border. And then at about 8 years of age, we moved then to Swanland Bar, which is just the southern side of the border, but still stayed within the same parish.
Were you coming from a farming background?
Yes, a small farming background, and my father had a shop, a country shop, as it was those times. But
What was your dad's name?
Pat Doonan.
And he ran a little grocery shop there, was it?
He did, he ran a grocery shop, and again, just on the border, and all of the smugglings, the butter, bacon, flour, for the time of the war that was rationed, everything and anything that was, because of the proximity to the border, it was a hive of activity. And as I said there, it's ironic now that people are talking about Brexit, because I suppose my father and that generation were brought up on smuggling, so
they made a living out of it.
They made a living out of it. So when someone, the first person said to me, what about Brexit? And I said, great, money to be made again. This is what we were reared on, so.
And that's what you grew up with, really?
Yes, and so smuggling and customs and borders and authorities. You couldn't go here, you couldn't go there. The British Army, customs, checkpoints, identification, who you were, people that you worked with. When you went out at night, were members of the UDR stop you? Someone that you worked with during the day, it'd have the audacity to ask you what your name was. So I used to say out the window, I say, Willie, she didn't forget it from 4 o'clock today.
So they all, everything kind of changed in the evening time when the part-time UDR were out on the road again.
Yes.
And so, and that's when the smuggling stopped, I'm sure.
The smuggling kept going, but that certainly hindered the free movement, let's say, because of
road closures.
The unapproved roads, and Swanland Bar, Kinnaly, there was 1, 2, 3, there were 4 roads which joined Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland that were unapproved. And then you had the main roads, which were the approved roads. So the customs post before the military, before you had the troubles and you had the British checkpoints on the northern side of the border, the customs regulated the roads you could go.
Yeah.
Because when we moved from Kinnaly to Swanland Bar, the shortest route to the house we had, and it was very complicated because the house that we bought in Swanland Bar was on the border, but the custom post was the first building in Swanland Bar, the village, half a mile. So we lived between the border and the customs post.
In no man's land.
And the shortest way for us to come in that time back, and that was 66. So when you crossed the border, you had a logbook. Okay? So you came the official way, and we used to have to go up by the house, up to the customs in Swanland Bar, go in with the logbook and get it checked. That was you checked in. Okay? So the customs, their hours, I think, was 8 to 5. So back down then to the house just beside the border where we were renovating for a couple of years, and that's why we were going forward and back. And then to go home then in the evening, you had to go up to get the book stamped, to stamp you out.
Yeah.
And then if you came in any one of the 4 unimproved roads, which was far the shortest, you had to make sure that you came in before 8 or after 5, because, you know, you were going past the... And if you did that, you had to make sure that you went home the same way, because you couldn't have 2 in stamps and 2 out stamps on the book.
I see. So you were...
We were regulated before the British Army set up the checkpoints by the customs.
Okay. And because you were a bordering house or a family, yeah, and with a small farm. Were you seen as somebody that, you know, could have been involved in some way?
Oh, yes, because TVs was a big thing, because there was a big difference in the duty on a TV south and north. So our buyer, there was a lot more than cows in it.
And so, but apart from all of that business going on, smuggling was there any any members of your family get involved in the troubles?
Yes.
How did that happen now, tell me?
That happened one Saturday. I went out, we had a small farm, and I went out the back to look at some of the cattle, or maybe there's a cow calving or something, and three fields out from the house, came across these two men with a heavy submachine gun mounted on the tripod, and the big belt with the bullets, probably 4 or 5 inches long, going through that, and I was shocked and delighted in a way to see these, because we had got a television in 66, so, you know, there were some of these westerns on, so to have no more than being able to see the 165 Massies and brag about those in the Ford 4000s, to actually see one of these things, in the real was, I suppose, looking back on it now, sure, it's, I'd have been only maybe 13, 14 years of age, maybe 15 at the most.
That's when you met these two?
Yeah.
Who were they?
I have the names of one of them, but I don't have the name of the other one.
Okay, but were they members of an organisation?
Oh, I'm quite sure. No, they weren't. I didn't ask them for that. They hadn't name badges, and I certainly didn't ask them for it. I was intrigued with the machinery or the artillery that they had and how it worked, and I was duly shown how it worked. So they said who they were, and I'm sure you won't be saying anything, son. So I said, no, I won't. And I would talk to them for a good while, and then I offered them tea and sandwiches. So they said they were hungry, they'd appreciate that. So I went in, and I had, it'd be nothing new or strange for me to be cooking. So I made the tea and the sandwiches. Thankfully, I got out of the house without anyone asking me what I was doing. So from that, I spent a good while of that afternoon, and then the next day, one of the British Army helicopters was fired upon, and a forced landing. And according to the news reports that were out, there was something, it was one of those bubble helicopters, you know, just kind of like a glass bubble. And I think they hit something at the back of the pilot's head, which forced the helicopter, you know, to land within a few miles where it was fired on. So it was more than likely the pair of boys I was talking to and the equipment that they had that did that. So, from that,
Were they strangers or were they local?
Oh, totally strangers. There was one of them from Donegal. I don't know where the other man was from. I met them again then. I befriended them, and I met them again then on numerous occasions.
Okay, and did they ask you to join?
No. I was 15. It went on for a few years, but I probably was 14 when I met them, and probably 16 or 17.
And so you followed their progress, say?
Oh, I followed what they were doing, and I had a great interest in what they had, and it was something that I never, ever, ever, ever told anybody. And I suppose I had to disclose then in the house what I had done and what I was doing. So it wasn't too, well, my father or my mother wasn't going to turn me in. There was reporting anything that was going on. My father was Fianna Fáil, and my mother too. Strong Fianna Fáil people. I had no political aspirations, or whatever you call it. Political parties at that age didn't mean anything to me.
So was it just the excitement of the whole
It would
thing?
Be the excitement, of course, and as somebody at my age. And it was just... and then it became... It became, I suppose, because of where our house was positioned. You used the words early on there for the tractors that used to come as a safe house and the television. So it became... I fell into that bracket. And the army checkpoint was just our landform, the border with Northern Ireland. And
so was it searched at any stage, or was it raided, in other words?
No, it wasn't. But in later years, when the Troubles, at the end of the Troubles, my father was arrested. And
your father?
He was, yeah, by the Gardaí. Which shouldn't have happened, but he wasn't charged with anything because, thankfully, the local sergeant knew that because of the position, location of the house, it wasn't that he, that was his political persuasion or aspirations. He was a Fianna Fáil man through and through.
But why was he arrested then?
Because of, I suppose, because of... connections were made with the house, which was my doing, and I suppose because I was
helping out,
and the local sergeant knew of the position because of the house being the proximity to the border,
yeah.
That we became involved, not intentional or not intending to be, we just became a victim of the circumstances, or more in particular, I suppose, the geographical situation.
Imagine that. Yeah, and so, but at any stage there was no kind of recruiting or wanting you to go on a mission with them or
no recruiting, because on a couple of occasions, on numerous occasions, when the army checkpoint would be fired upon, and it was always from our land that it was fired upon. So we used to get there'd be a tap on the back door, and you knew that was bring in the dog and go to bed. So shortly after that...
But explain that now. Who tapped on the back door?
Well, it was one of these two men that...
Oh, yes.
That I had befriended.
Oh, right. And so they came in and they stayed the night, like...
They'd be down. No. They tapped the door, which was the code for that they were going down to launch an attack.
Oh, I see.
And to make sure that we were all inside and they knew the dog was... Sailor wasn't too... I think it was Sailor, maybe it was an earlier one, but there was one of the dogs wasn't too fond of the gunfire. So,
were you ever approached then by the British, say the UDR, the B Specials, or did any of those?
They wouldn't have. They'd had no idea. They'd know the location. Where the firing took place from, or in the vicinity.
Yeah,
they'd know probably by the type of the bullets, what caliber of gun fired that,
yeah,
and what range it had, and probably the direction it came from, they'd be able to say, well, if it wasn't that field, it was that one. But that was all pointing towards our house.
But why weren't you suspect then?
I don't honestly know. I suppose my mother and father, mother was a teacher, my father was... he wasn't involved, and I suppose it was known that he wasn't involved, and it was just taken that, it was our land and we had no control over, and they definitely didn't know that I had befriended two of these guys. And of course I never told anybody, and other than, I'd be going to school. I went to secondary school, primary school in Swanlambar, and then went to secondary school in St. Phelan's in Ballinamore and Leitrim. And when they would fire on the Brits, naturally they'd return fire with heavy machine guns. And thankfully the gable wall of our house, because we had renovated the house when we bought it, and that gable wall wasn't touched. It was a stone wall, and it must have been probably 2 feet, you know, 2 feet wide, and it's all the better that it was, because the rest of it was tossed and was built in the new the cavity blocks. So you'd see the red flashes going by the window, which was the British Army returning the fire. And then in the morning I'd be out with the knitting needle fishing the shells out of the gable wall, and I'd be bringing out of pockets of those going to school. So I'd have those as paperweights and
to show them off.
This is what I have, you know. So I was a great fella. I had all this these shells and the gable, there was many's a hole in the Bayard of Warren. Around the street, my father's van was hit on one occasion, but that was a
way of life, wasn't it?
That was a regular occurrence. Yeah, when you'd hear the tap on the door, you knew that was the launch was about to happen. So bring in the dog and go to bed.
But this is what you grew up with. It was very much part of your, you know, the excitement, the idea of being. Yeah. You know, that you're talking to people who were involved, in other words.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's extraordinary how you escaped not getting involved yourself, you know, getting...
I suppose I was too young. I was 75 when Kevin Cohen was shot. Kevin Cohen from Sligo, Riversdale and Sligo. Riverstown in Sligo. He was shot, I think it was January 75. And that brought it very near, because he was shot very close, you know, to our house, but on the northern side. And there's a story of the local parish priest, or maybe curate as he was that time, we knew him, is Canon Liam Gaffney. So he was the parish priest in Kinnaly. So when the news of that fatality became known, naturally the priest was called to go to the scene to give the man his last rites. So the British Army, of course, had everything sealed off. The roads were all sealed off. And he came up to a checkpoint at the crossroads before the field where Kevin had been shot. And the British Army, they stopped him, naturally, and they always addressed him as Padre. So they said, "Good evening, Padre. There's been an incident up the road, and the road is closed. Wherever you're going, you know, you can't go any further." Uh-huh. So he had a habit of saying, uh-huh, uh-huh. And he was our football trainer and boxing trainer. So he never ever told us now, he never made it known what his political aspirations or political persuasions were. But so he said that that's where he was going. His mission was to go to this man and give him the last rites. Mm-hmm. So they said, "Padre, unfortunately, you won't be able to do that." And it wasn't the days of the electric windows, so, you know, it was wind down. So Canon Gaffney had a habit of saying, "Ahem, ahem. So what happens if I drive through?" And they said, "Well, Padre, we'll start shooting." And he started to wind up the window. "Ah," he says, "you better start shooting then." And he drove straight through.
Go away.
Yeah, I went up and gave Kevin the last rite. So that's
an extraordinary thing.
Yeah,
isn't it?
"You better start shooting then," he said. And he wound up the window and let out the clutch and went straight through the checkpoint.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So there's a lot. There's a monument to Kevin Moen, Cohen, just... at what we called Cassidy's Cross. A lot of people had known where the Mullen Market of a Sunday is. There was also then the...
And why was he shot now? Or how was he?
Well, he was one of the volunteers, or one of the
IRA.
IRA. And that's...
He was on a mission.
He was on a mission, yeah. So then we had the border roads then were all blown up because the checkpoints were back to the same, similar to the customs. So the customs were on the official routes.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what the army checkpoint set up. So then all the minor roads or concession roads, as they were called, they were all blown up, you know, to stop the movement of the IRA. So, there was one incident that I certainly will remember, and will remember till the day I go to the grave, was I was outside with my father, were doing something on the land, and there was one incident that I'll remember, and I'll remember till the day I go to my grave, is that myself and my father were outside doing something on the farm, and we heard this loud bang, and we knew it was very, very close. So the next thing then, we seen the cloud of dust, smoke, so we knew it was north of our house, so it had to be the custom post. So we went down on the tractor, and surely enough, there was the steel frame remaining of the building, and all of the brickwork, everything was blown out. It was just, everything was gone except the steel frame that was left. So we were looking at this, there was no sign of anybody, and the dust was only settling. And then the next thing, the phone rings. So this, and we looked around and no one could see, and it rings again. So my father says, that's in the hedge. So over he goes to the hedge, and right enough, there's the phone. He lifts the receiver and says, hello. And this lady says, is that Mullen Customs Post? And my father says, well, I'm afraid he says, it was. It's no longer. And she says, what do you mean? It's after being blown up. I'm answering the phone in the hedge.
That's an extraordinary thing to happen, wasn't it?
That happened.
My goodness, yeah. And roughly, what time?
Do you
have an idea?
It's early 70s. The trouble started in 69, so 70... 72, 73.
Okay, and that customs post was which?
Mullen Customs Post, which is the one I showed you. It was on the road from Swanlumbar to Enniskillen.
Imagine. And where you were then, did that put you out? Did you have to drive?
We were on one of the official, on the official route. Yes. Because wherever the customs were, if you were on that, or you were on the official route. Well, we were okay, except that, you know, you had the army checkpoint.
Yeah.
And every time you went down to go, because we'd have went to Enniskillen and Kinnaly. Like I played my football and boxing, and everything was in Kinnaly, even though I lived in Swanlumbar, because I was from Kinnaly, and there's where I played. So every time you went anywhere, our shopping town would have been Enniskillen, not Cavan. So you had to go through the checkpoint. It was just, when you think of it now, you know, I don't know how people suffered or tolerated, you know, what went on, the harassment.
And so did you hold two passports then?
No, just the one. But
which one?
Irish one. Yeah. But I would be entitled to a British one, I'm sure, but I never. I might, with Brexit now, it could come in handy that I was born in Northern Ireland, so therefore I'm sure I qualify for one.
So in the house then... stuff. I mean, was there any firearms or explosives left in the house at any stage?
Possibly firearms, yes.
And so these would be kind of, because it was a safe house, they would be left. So were
they weren't left though? They wouldn't be left in the house. They were
in one of the barns.
In one of the barns, as I said about, you know, the TVs in the byre.
Yeah,
you know, as well as the cows, there were other pieces of hardware. I think hardware.
But you were there. Were you given the job of cleaning them or looking after them or oiling them or?
I'd have liked that job. I'd have loved that job. But I knew where they were.
Okay, and then they would be missing, and then they would appear again.
Yes. So let's say I would make sure that the cows wouldn't tramp on them, or they wouldn't be visually seen for somebody walking in and out. So I knew what was there and where it was.
So, Tony, even though you weren't involved at all, but you were, you knew, you were privy to what was happening every day. How do you feel about it now? Do you think, did you think at any time that maybe you should have gone into the local Garda station to say exactly what you were doing or what happened?
No, that never crossed my mind. No, no, definitely so, not.
So did you see yourself as a sympathiser then? You were deeply
well, I suppose I was deeply affected. I was fascinated, I suppose, was probably the first and foremost, the first reaction. I suppose looking back now on what you could say, I was definitely involved. But it was circumstances. It just wasn't something that I went to look for. It was something that happened. The way the thing developed and evolved, I suppose I became whatever I was classed as. I wouldn't class myself as being involved, okay. We can say I facilitated. But I never had the slightest intention or notion of going anywhere to report anything, because nobody was doing that at those times, and I didn't see or believe it was a thing to do.
And so was it very much them and us then? Like you were coming from a, as you say, Fianna Fáil background and staunch. I won't say Republican, but
Yeah. And I suppose the Fianna Fáil party was a Republican party then, which it's not. It's gone to be more aligned with a Dublin Four party now.
Did you see the Ulster Unionist Protestants then your enemy?
Definitely not the enemy. I suppose when I look back on it now and look at, you know, any of the jobs, you know, the postman, even though our postman in the north, he was John Patrick Brennan, he was a Catholic. But there was just so many jobs that a Catholic didn't qualify for. And certainly the fire service. The fire service, bus drivers, and the postman's job. There was no postwomen that I knew of in those days anyway. But Catholics just didn't get those jobs. But no more than the situation that I found myself involved in, there wasn't, in our community, there wasn't a song and dance made about it or talked about round the fireside about, look at Robert, you know, he's a postman, and Fred, you know, he gets driving the bus. This was all very lucrative. It was extra income because we were all farmers.
Okay.
You know, but they got the rich pickings, and it was quite obvious that the Catholics didn't. And I suppose from that, I suppose the troubles erupted, you know, the oppression.
And so I have to ask you this. Was there a sense of mistrust and not trusting, you know, your neighbour?
No, where I was brought up, we had a few Protestant neighbours, and God, there was no absolutely weren't looked upon as anything different just because their name might have been Fred or Cheryl rather than Pat or John or Peter.
But what about the Michael you spoke about, who was helping you out in the daytime and part time UDR in the evening?
Willie.
It was Willie, yes.
Well, he wasn't a neighbour. Well, he was from Florence Court, which was two or three parishes away, but that was when the troubles started. But before the troubles started, you know, all these things, they were happening. But I suppose as being...
No, I'm talking about trouble time during the 1972 onwards.
No, well, our Protestant neighbours were still the same to us, because they weren't involved in it no more than we weren't involved in it. Okay, you might say, that's rich for you saying you weren't involved in it, and what I'm after saying on record, but I didn't intentionally, without repeating it, was circumstances, and this is where we were. We had no grudge on the neighbours. Let them be the Protestant relations that we had were still as good. We had Protestant neighbours that they progressed from the horse or the ass and cart, and they bought a tractor. And as a teenager, I done all the work for them. You know, I done the mowing for them and done whatever else had to be done. And they used to come cailing in our house. So, you know, it wasn't us and them, a Catholic and Protestant, in our community. But once the trouble started and once the Brits arrived, you know, that changed the whole landscape. Because then we were harassed because of being Catholics. The British Army weren't too bad. In actual fact, I got to know one of the British Army guys quite well.
When you say the Brits, what do you mean? The specials?
No, the British, the soldiers that were at the checkpoints, and then the soldiers that you would meet on foot patrol.
Yeah.
You could be stopped anywhere. The red light would go up and you'd be stopped. And I would prefer, you know, to have met late at night, the Brits, as we call them.
Who are the Brits?
The Brits would be the English, English, Scottish and Welsh soldiers that were deployed in Northern Ireland, you know, because of the Troubles. And it's ironic, they came in, their initial mission was to save the Catholics from being slaughtered in Belfast, but the whole thing turned round. But it was the UDR. The UDR was the greatest recruiting agent for the Provost, because that was the really, really, really bigoted Protestant getting legalized to go out and harass his Catholic neighbour.
I see. So,
and that's what I referred to the Willie.
Yeah.
You know, it was, they just, as I said, I couldn't do it to my Protestant neighbours. Now, none of our Protestant neighbours, well, maybe there was one family. And there was one family. And but there was people, there was Protestants that joined the UDR for the money. And I suppose you couldn't blame them for that. But there was certainly not a minority of them, there could have been a majority of them, that it was, as well as getting the money, it was being able to harass, you know, your Catholic neighbour and just stamp it home about, you know, this is a two-tier society. You know, there's us, we have, and there are you, the have-nots. And I suppose that leaves my conscience clear that whatever I was involved in or did, I'd have no regrets in doing it all over again, because of the harassment that I got from travelling, as I said, you know, to Northern Ireland to go to play football and go to boxing, and to be stopped on the road, and someone that would know you no more than Willie saying, you know, and getting you out and opening the boot, and it raining and snow, and then the British soldiers then became corrupt by the bad element of the UDR or B specials, as they were, and I suppose they then turned against the Catholics. You know, we a Catholic became, you know,
okay,
an enemy and was to be targeted.
Okay, and just tell me one more thing. Could you tell me the casualties of all of this? Did you know the people who were shot and killed, or were you?
I did, yes, I did, on both sides. I did, yes, and there was terrible, when you look back at it now, there are terrible atrocities. But
were you close to any of these people that...
I was, killed? Yes, I was, yeah. A cousin of my own was killed in 90... I think it was the early 90s, 90... 90 or 91.
Who was that?
Kevin McGovern from Kinnaly. It claims, I think, genuinely it was mistaken identity. I don't think that whoever shot him deliberately or maliciously set out to shoot him, but he was shot by the security forces. I think they claim, you know, that they called on him to halt and he ran. So he was only a young fella, so that's a relation of mine that was shot. And then there was people then, like, I knew of Louis Leonard, Jim Murphy, I knew personally and knew him well, as he used to do a welding job for me. And he was the local garage. There'd be a lot of people that I would have known. But again, that was the times that we lived in. Look back on it now, it's horrifying to look back and see what happened, and a lot of innocent people that got killed. But that's the way it is in life. You know, the innocent do suffer, and you get caught up. But that's what happens in every, whether you call it uprising or rebellion. Or yeah. Kevin Cohen that was shot, he was pitching hay with me on the Saturday.
Yeah,
in the hay shed.
And he was dead.
He was dead on the Monday. He went Monday morning. But so Dermot Crowley. Yeah, he was. Again, I was the last civilian to see him before he died. Same with Kevin Cohen. But it was all brought about by people. It just shows people power. And it was nowhere more evident than, you know, the Iron Curtain. Yeah. You know, when the people said enough was enough, the wall came down, the nuclear weaponry, submarines, the latest of all the army, some of it that I'd love to have in comparison to the stuff I was talking about, became rendered useless.
Yeah.
When people said enough's enough, and the people in Northern Ireland took enough. And it's still going on today to an awful lot lesser extent.
Yeah. But it's still toxic.
It's still toxic. It's when you go in and, you know, yeah, you have to say whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant on a job application form, and when you put down a Catholic,
yeah,
it was like a turkey voting for Christmas.
Tony, thanks. Tony Doonan, thank you very much indeed.